If you were to walk into a room and just observe two people at the absolute peak of two very specific drug experiences, one on Salvia divinorum and the other on a really high dose of ketamine, you would probably assume they had taken the exact same
No,
substance.
absolutely. From the outside, they look identical.
Right. I mean, they are completely detached from their physical bodies, totally disconnected from the room around them, and their consensus reality has just, completely evaporated.
Yeah, it's a total dismantling of the self and the environment. When you look at them, you're basically looking at the absolute definition of a shattered reality. There's no response to external stimuli at all. They are just gone.
Gone. But if you could somehow like shrink down and zoom into the microscopic chemical mechanisms happening inside their brains in that exact moment, you would find that the roads they took to get to that shattered reality could not possibly be more different.
Literal opposite sides of the neurochemical universe.
Exactly. So welcome to the deep dive. Today we are taking you, our listener, on a journey into how convergent experiences in human consciousness arise from radically divergent pharmacology.
It is such a fascinating topic.
It really is. And our source material today is this incredibly detailed, frankly mind-blowing, July 2026 article from the OOTW Journal. It's titled Salvia versus Ketamine: How Two Drugs Dissolve Reality Through Completely Different Receptors.
Yeah, and that paper acts as just a perfect lens for examining how our brains construct reality in the first place, mostly by looking at how these two specific chemical keys dismantle it.
Right. And for you listening, whether you're fascinated by the bleeding edge of neuroscience, deeply curious about the mechanics of human consciousness, or if you're just trying to track the rapidly evolving multi-billion-dollar world of depression treatments, this comparison is an absolute masterclass.
It really strips away so many assumptions we make about how the brain actually works.
It does. But before we get into the wildly different chemistry, we really need to define the shared destination. We've used the word dissociation already, but how does a dissociative state actually compare to what we normally think of when we hear the word psychedelic?
Well, that distinction is exactly where we have to start. Because when most people think of classic psychedelics, psilocybin, LSD, mescaline, DMT, they are thinking of molecules that plug directly into the serotonin 5-HT2A receptor.
Right, the classic serotonin pathway.
Exactly. And activating that specific receptor generally creates a very emotionally open, visually vibrant, highly meaningful journey. The user usually feels this intense, almost overwhelming connection to the
To
universe.
nature or like to their own internal emotional landscape, right? That's the classic expansion of consciousness we always hear about. You feel at one with everything.
Right.
But from what I read in the article, neither salvia nor ketamine touches that serotonin receptor at all.
Not a single interaction. They completely bypass the 5-HT2A system.
Wow.
Yeah, so instead of expanding connection, they produce profound dissociation. So instead of feeling deeply connected to everything, the whole concept of you and the environment surrounding you are forcefully pulled apart,
which is wild.
it is. And brain imaging actually shows that both of these drugs heavily attenuate the brain's default mode network.
And the default mode network, or the DMN,
I know.
that's the network responsible for our self-referential thoughts, right? Like our internal monologue, our sense of ego, our autobiographical memory.
Precisely. It's the neurological system that tells you who you are, where you are, and what your relationship is to the room you're currently sitting in.
Okay, let me try an analogy here, because thinking about networks can get, a bit abstract.
Go for it.
If we think of the default mode network, like a computer's operating system, a classic psychedelic like psilocybin is maybe like opening up a dozen heavy, intense new software programs all at once.
Yeah, the screen is just flooded with vivid, complex applications running at maximum capacity.
Right. But salvia and ketamine, they aren't opening new programs at all.
No, they are doing the exact opposite. If we stick to your computer analogy, salvia and ketamine act like two entirely different, highly specialized computer viruses whose sole function is to just crash the operating system entirely.
Just a total crash.
Yeah, you don't get new, vibrant software. You get the blue screen of death, the ego, the self. It just goes offline completely.
And the craziest part to me is how they trigger that crash.
Well, what's fascinating here is this concept of convergent experience. They arrive at the exact same destination, the blue screen of death, or dissociation. But from a neuropharmacological standpoint, that shared phenomenology is where the similarities permanently end.
The roads just fork.
Completely.
Yeah.
From the moment the system crashes, their mechanisms never cross paths again.
Which brings us to the actual mechanisms, because the way salvia triggers that system crash is just bizarre. I mean, structurally, chemically, it's an absolute outlier in the world of neuroscience, isn't it?
It really stands alone. The active compound in the salvia plant is called salvinorin A. And in the world of neuropharmacology, it is a total structural anomaly. The paper defines it as a non-nitrogenous neoclaridane deuterpene.
Okay, I am definitely going to need a translation on non-nitrogenous neoclaridane deuterpene. That is a mouthful.
Yeah, the most important part of that phrase is non-nitrogenous. Basically, it's a plant molecule that contains absolutely no basic nitrogen atom.
Okay, which means what exactly?
It might sound like a minor chemistry detail, but almost every single drug that acts on the central nervous system has a basic nitrogen atom. It's practically a biochemical requirement for crossing the blood-brain barrier and binding to brain receptors.
Oh, wow. So like serotonin, dopamine, LSD, cocaine, they all have it.
Yes, all of them. But salvinorin A doesn't. It essentially sneaks into the brain without the standard VIP pass, yet it is wildly potent.
So it's breaking the rules of neurochemistry.
Exactly. Mm. And not only is it potent, it is incredibly precise. It is highly selective, over 5,000-fold selective, for one specific target, which is the kappa opioid receptor, or KOR.
Okay, let's unpack this, because you just said opioid receptor.
I did.
When you or I or anyone else listening hears the word opioid, we immediately think of things like fentanyl, heroin, oxycodone, morphine.
Of course.
We think of profound euphoria, severe physical addiction, and the very real danger of respiratory depression and fatal overdoses. So if salvia is an opioid agonist, meaning it activates an opioid receptor, why doesn't it cause the euphoria or the addiction or, you know, stop your breathing like fentanyl does?
Right. It's a huge misconception. It's because the word opioid is actually an umbrella term for a whole family of receptors, and they do wildly different things. Fentanyl and heroin target the mu opioid receptor system. The mu system governs reward, euphoria, pain relief, and unfortunately respiratory drive. But salvinorin A has basically zero affinity for that mu receptor. It completely ignores it.
It just bypasses it entirely.
Completely. Instead, it selectively targets the kappa opioid receptor. And the kappa system operates almost as the neurological mirror image of the mu system.
A mirror image in what way? It does the exact reverse.
Essentially, yes. In the brain, the endogenous or naturally occurring activators for the mu system are endorphins, which make you feel great.
Right. Runner's high and all that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But the activators for the kappa system are called dynorphins. And dynorphins are part of a deeply embedded stress and aversion circuit. The kappa opioid receptor is essentially the brain's built-in dysphoria switch.
A dysphoria switch? That sounds awful.
It is. When you activate it, it reliably produces anxiety, a strong sense of physical aversion, and bizarre, often terrifying psychotomimetic effects.
Wait, so when people talk about how terrifying a salvia trip is, that isn't just, like, a side effect of taking too much?
Not at all. It's not a bad trip in the psychological sense, where you're just having a tough time processing some trauma or, you know, being in a bad environment.
It's mechanical.
Yes. The dysphoria is the direct mechanical pharmacology of the drug. Salvia shares the word opioid, but because it flips the kappa switch instead of the mu switch, it shares absolutely none of the euphoric or dangerous respiratory profile of classical opioids.
That is just wild to think about. It's a pure chemical aversion mechanism. It literally forces your brain to feel a sense of dread and detachment.
Exactly. A plant that flawlessly targets a built-in nightmare circuit.
Now, if salvia is throwing an aversive opioid switch to crash the operating system, the article notes that ketamine takes an entirely different route to get to that same crash. It doesn't touch the opiate system at all, does it?
No, not even a little. It takes the most excitatory pathway possible. Ketamine operates heavily on the glutamate system, which is the primary excitatory neurotransmitter in the brain.
And glutamate is all about action, right? Signaling and firing.
Right. Specifically, ketamine acts as a non-competitive NMDA receptor antagonist.
Meaning it blocks the NMDA receptor. But if glutamate is excitatory and ketamine blocks it, shouldn't that just, you know, shut the brain down? How does that lead to a wild dissociative trip?
It's a bit more of a bank shot than a direct shutdown. It operates on what neuroscientists call the disinhibition hypothesis.
Okay, how does that work?
It literally sits inside the open ion channel of the NMDA glutamate receptor, like a microscopic cork, and it jams it shut. But it preferentially targets the NMDA receptors on very specific neurons, the inhibitory GABA interneurons.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Let me see if we can co-build an analogy here to make this visual for everyone listening.
Let's do it.
If we think of the human brain like a moving car, the excitatory neurons are the gas pedal constantly trying to push the car forward.
Yep.
And the inhibitory GABA neurons are the brakes, keeping that speed in check.
That's a perfect framework. Right. So in a normal sober state, the brakes and the gas are working in harmony. But ketamine comes in and specifically blocks the receptors on the GABA neurons.
So going back to the car analogy, ketamine doesn't press the gas. It literally cuts the brake lines.
Exactly. And because the brakes are completely gone, the engine, which is the excitatory glutamate system, briefly revs up completely out of control.
Wow.
Precisely. By disinhibiting the system, removing the brakes, you get this massive, brief glutamate surge, particularly in the prefrontal cortex.
And what happens with all that extra glutamate?
That surge of glutamate overflows. Because the normal NMDA receptors are blocked by the ketamine cork, that excess glutamate spills over and violently activates a second type of receptor called the AMPA receptor.
Ah, the AMPA receptor.
Yeah, and that AMPA activation is the magic key for ketamine. It kicks off a profound biological cascade, releasing brain-derived neurotrophic factor, or BDNF, and activating something called the MTOR pathway.
And the sources emphasize BDNF and the MTOR pathway heavily, because those are the engines of neuroplasticity, right?
Oh.
It's often described almost like Miracle Grow for the brain. We're talking about the actual physical rebuilding of the brain's wiring.
We are talking about the literal sprouting of new architecture. It quite literally stimulates the growth of new dendritic spines and synapses.
That's incredible.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, this plasticity cascade is the leading model for why ketamine acts as such a rapid, powerful antidepressant.
Right, because they can actually prove that, can't they?
Yeah, we know this because scientists have run experiments where they introduce a secondary drug that blocks that AMPA step. And when they do that, the antidepressant effect of ketamine completely vanishes.
So without the AMPA activation, it doesn't cure the depression.
Exactly. The patient still dissociates. They still get the blue screen of death we talked about, but the mood repair does not happen. The magic of ketamine lies in the downstream plasticity, not merely in the dissociation itself.
Even with that understanding, the sources show there are still intense debates in the scientific community about the exact nuances of this. I mean, even now, in 2026, scientists are arguing about ketamine's enantiomers, right?
Oh, constantly.
The left and right-handed molecular versions, the SNR forms, and how its metabolite, hydroxyne or ketamine, might actually be driving some of the antidepressant effects independently.
The pharmacology of ketamine is still fiercely debated, which is actually incredible considering how long we've used it in medicine.
Hmm.
For instance, the S form, esketamine, is a much more potent NMDA blocker. It cuts the brakes very efficiently.
Okay.
But the R form shows strong antidepressant activity despite weaker binding. And that hydroxyne or ketamine metabolite you mentioned, some researchers believe it activates AMPA directly, bypassing the NMDA cork entirely.
Bypassing the brakes altogether.
Yeah. But regardless of which camp wins that debate eventually, the overarching through line remains solid. Salvia opens a dynorphin-driven dysphoria switch, while ketamine jams a glutamate channel to unleash a storm of neuroplasticity.
Because the underlying chemistry is so drastically different, it makes total sense that the actual real-world experiences of taking these drugs, you know, their duration, what they feel like, and their specific hazards, are completely distinct.
Completely different hazard curves.
Right. It's not a matter of one being universally safer than the other. They just operate entirely differently. Let's look at salvia first. When a user smokes or vapes salvinorin A, it is incredibly fast. The sources say it hits peak brain concentration in about 40 seconds, with a brain half-life of roughly 8 minutes.
The speed is staggering, and the reason it vanishes so quickly is due to esterase enzymes in the blood.
What do those do?
These enzymes basically recognize the chemical structure of salvinorin A and essentially shred the molecule apart almost immediately. The subjective experience is often described in the literature as a jagged detonation.
A jagged detonation? That sounds intense.
It is. A user goes from stone cold sober to a complete dissolution of the universe in under a minute, and they are back to baseline reality less than 10 minutes later.
And the hazards of salvia are entirely acute, right? I mean, physiologically, its toxicity is incredibly low. The sources note there are no verified deaths from the chemical itself shutting down the body.
That's correct.
And what I find so fascinating is that salvia's built-in bad trip mechanism, that kappa opioid dynorphin aversion we talked about, is exactly what prevents it from becoming a drug of widespread abuse.
Yeah, it is entirely self-limiting.
Right. The human brain actively dislikes the experience, so you don't see addiction centers full of salvia users.
You rarely see repeat heavy users at all. The real danger of salvia is purely situational and psychological. In those brief 8 minutes of acute terror and complete spatial disorientation, a person can easily physically injure themselves if they try to move around, or they can experience profound psychological distress.
Because they literally don't know they're in a room anymore.
Exactly. That's why harm reduction always emphasizes a safe setting and a sober sitter. As of 2026, it remains an unscheduled substance at the federal level, though it is banned or restricted in roughly 27 to 30 states.
Now contrast that jagged detonation with ketamine. Ketamine is typically administered via IV, intramuscular injection, or nasal spray. It's not a 40-second explosion. It's what the article calls a longer immersive drift that unfolds over 45 to 90 minutes.
Much slower onset.
Yeah, and unlike salvia's immediate dread, at lower doses, ketamine is actually described as dreamy and euphoric before the user hits that immobile decay hole at higher doses.
And because it can be dreamy and euphoric, the hazard profile shifts entirely. Ketamine's risks are cumulative, not just acute. It has a very real abuse and dependence liability.
Because people actually want to go back to that dreamy state.
Exactly. But if used heavily and sustained over time, it causes severe bladder toxicity, specifically ulcerative cystitis, which is the physical scarring and shrinking of the bladder.
That sounds awful.
It can be agonizing and sometimes irreversible. It also causes transient spikes in blood pressure and heart rate during the infusion. It is a Schedule 3 controlled substance, heavily regulated, though DEA telehealth flexibilities have kept remote prescribing accessible through the end of 2026.
So essentially, salvia's danger is falling out a window or severely injuring yourself during a terrifying 8-minute window of acute panic, while ketamine's danger is a slow accumulation of bodily damage and psychological dependence from chronic overuse.
It's a perfect comparison. It's not that one is safe and one is dangerous. They just have entirely different hazard curves based on how they interact with our biology.
This brings us to a massive shift in how we view these substances. How do these two wildly different chemical mechanisms translate into the massive multi-billion dollar business of modern psychiatry?
It's a tale of two very different outcomes.
Because as we head into late 2026, the trajectories of these two reality-bending compounds have run in completely opposite directions in the medical world.
Ketamine, of course, is the great psychiatric success story of the modern era. Its S-enantiomer, esketamine, marketed under the brand name Spravato, was approved way back in 2019.
Right, for depression.
Yes. But notably, in January 2025, it was finally cleared by the FDA as a standalone monotherapy for treatment-resistant depression. It is a proven, evidence-based, highly legal medicine that has frankly reshaped psychiatry.
But the salvia side, the kappa opioid system, presents what researchers in the sources call the kappa paradox in drug development. And honestly, the logic here is brilliant.
It made perfect sense on paper.
Right. Pharmaceutical companies looked at salvia and said, okay, a kappa opioid agonist turns on the dysphoria switch and causes severe anxiety and aversion. So hypothetically, if we create a kappa opioid antagonist, a drug that fits into that same receptor but blocks it instead of activating it, we should be able to turn off the brain's internal aversion circuit and cure depression.
Yeah, it was a beautiful, elegant hypothesis. The idea was to block the endogenous dynorphins that are theoretically causing anhedonia and depressive states in millions of people.
It sounds like a perfect solution.
It does. If you can chemically block the brain's ability to feel despair, you have a blockbuster drug. It sparked massive financial investment and huge phase 3 clinical trials over the last few years.
So what does this all mean for patients? Did it actually work?
Unfortunately, no. The reality check in 2025 and 2026 was incredibly harsh for these pharmaceutical companies. The neat theory on paper completely failed in human practice.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Johnson & Johnson had a flagship kappa antagonist called Aticaprint. They discontinued it for major depressive disorder in early 2025 after phase 3 failures. Another major player, Neumora, had a heavily funded drug called Navacaprant.
And what happened with that one?
It failed its first pivotal trial in January 2025, and by June 2026, it failed its remaining phase 3 trials, and they had to completely end the program.
Wow. So the multi-billion dollar theory of using KR antagonists for depression is essentially dead in the water right now.
Pretty much.
What about salvinorin A itself? Is there any medical future for the actual salvia compound, or is it just a pharmacological oddity?
It has a future, but only in the preclinical stages right now. Scientists are working with analogs, which are, you know, slightly tweaked versions of the molecule, like 16-bromosalvinorin A.
Okay.
They're trying to harness its unique properties to create non-addictive pain relief and anti-addiction medications.
Yeah.
In rodent trials, they've actually found that it blunts cocaine-seeking behavior, supposedly without triggering the terrifying dysphoria.
That would be huge if it works.
It would. But as of 2026, there are zero completed human efficacy trials. It is entirely a scientific frontier, miles away from your local pharmacy. This raises an important question, though, about the hubris of modern medicine.
How so?
Well, we can map these receptors perfectly, down to the single atom. We could design molecules to fit into those receptors like perfectly machined keys. But the human brain is so staggeringly complex that reversing a mechanism on paper, like trying to just block a dysphoria switch, does not guarantee a cure in an actual human patient.
It really just highlights how much we still don't know. You can't just find the sadness receptor, put a pharmacological cork in it, and expect the depression to instantly vanish.
Right.
The brain just doesn't work in a linear way.
It is deeply humbling for neuroscientists. It reminds us that biological systems adapt, they compensate, and they really defy simple equations.
So to summarize the journey we've been on today for you listening, we have looked at two completely different chemical keys. One is a highly selective, non-nitrogenous, aversive opioid switch that triggers the brain's innate nightmare circuit. And the other is a plasticity-driving glutamate blocker that cuts the neurological brakes and forces the brain to physically rewire itself. And yet, if you zoom out to the macro level, both of these radically different mechanisms unlock the exact same bizarre doorway.
A state of profound dissociation where consensus reality is entirely dissolved. A convergent experience born of divergent pharmacology. I think it perfectly encapsulates how resilient, mysterious, and complex the architecture of human consciousness really is.
It really does. And as we wrap up, I want to leave you, our listener, with a final thought to mull over, something the source has touched on but we didn't fully explore today. We learned that salvia works by flawlessly hijacking the brain's endogenous dynorphin system, which is a naturally occurring stress, aversion, and dysphoria circuit.
Right, it's already built into us.
Exactly. So if our brains naturally possess this intense reality-dissolving switch inside of us right now, what possible evolutionary purpose did it serve for our ancient ancestors?
That is the million-dollar question.
Right. Why did biology program us with a built-in, innate mechanism capable of producing such extreme, terrifying detachment from reality? What was it meant to protect us from?
It's eerie to think about.
It really is. Think about that the next time you assume reality is just a given, solid thing.
I want to thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the consensus, keep looking beneath the surface, and we will catch you next time.